Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And join us in London again as we visit old friends and at new places.
Yeah, it's sort of a play on those because a couple of them are slightly different than that, but you sort of get the drift. If you've listened to On the Menu's London coverage before, then at least the chef's name or the restaurant name or both will be familiar. And it seemed like they all
previous years.
From previous years. It's sort of like all together now. It's musical chairs. Where will you be when the music stops?
Right.
And one of the most dramatic, I think it would be fair to say, shifts in the London chef placement business is our old friend Jeremy Lee.
Who we thought would never leave Blueprint Cafe.
Yeah, he told us he'd be at Blueprint Cafe until he died. Yeah. And somehow or other, our good old friends Sam and Eddie Hart of Quo Vadis and the rest of the Hart group, including their Spanish places, somehow they managed to tempt Jeremy away. And I think we sort of got a little bit of a clue when Jeremy said in the interview that basically they said, you can do anything you feel like. And if you know Jeremy, and you will after this interview, even if you didn't know him before, you'll know that he's quite the character and quite the loose cannon, wouldn't you say? But he's a loose cannon who happens to be a genius at the stove in bringing alive traditional English tastes, traditional English flavors, fascinating new ingredients, really setting a wonderful table at Quo Vadis. So,
and we talk about that in this interview.
Yes, we do. So here's Jeremy. Go.
Well, listeners, I'm going to share with you my most favorite chef, my most favorite British chef, too, is Jeremy Lee, who has appeared for the first time out of the Blueprint Cafe and is now at Quo Vadis. And I said, Jeremy, you've put this restaurant on the map in London, and you have. All of a sudden, you're getting ink saying, raving about the food. Now, the building itself has always been interesting, right?
Yes, exactly so. It's a lovely old, very gracious old darling from dating God 1926. And there's four London townhouses. I think three of them are Georgian and one is Victorian, I think. All sort of bolstered together. So I've got a very lovely restaurant, but behind it's like Gormenghast. Staircases all over the place. And, you know, it's very cockamamie. Highly amusing.
Well, you've changed everything in terms of the kitchen, haven't you?
Yeah, I have to say, teaming up with Sam and Eddie, they were magnanimous and gregarious and very generous partners and bosses, who just said, whatever you want, you can have. When Liberty Hall opens its doors, it's hard to resist. So we just went at it, and I think being such an extravagant building, it suddenly seemed to make very good sense to pare all the walls back and take all the art down and simplify it and make it very much more plain. So it was just about the food and the people.
It is indeed. And I love your menu. How would you describe your menu?
Well, the menu is, it's a combination of years and years and years, but it is a combination of home cooking, but honed by years cooking with folk like Alistair Little and Simon Hopkinson. So it's very accomplished, very ingredient-driven, seasonal. I mean, these are terms that are bandied around all over the place, but, you know, we try to hold quite true to it and keep it quite real. And we change it every day, so as soon as something new comes in, we get it on the menu. Each little bug that pops up. It's this rather dull spring, which never seems to have ended, actually, this year. So we're blessed by great suppliers and producers who get on the blower as soon as something's available and say, do you want something? We go, yes, please, no. So we're very fortunate, very spoiled, considering we're right in the middle of London, to have such wonderful friends who support us.
Well, you revived an interest in Peter of something that I had never heard of called a kickshaw.
Yeah, no, they were a great thing. My mum used to do them years and years ago when we were children for her friends when they came out for dinner. And it's an old French term, cacachos, which was when the cook had rolled out the pastry and then we just, you know, the leftovers got jam wrapped in them and then popped in the oven and it was just a little guijo or a little something. And in English it was corrupted to a kickshaw.
But,
yeah, exactly. So, but most of them are rickshaws, you know. And it's just, you know, it's got absolutely no culinary legs whatsoever, but they're immensely jolly and good fun and delicious. And they sort of suit what we do. And it's very nice to have something of mum's on the menu as well, which is great.
But you decided they should be savoury instead of sweet.
Yes, I've never been very fond of deep-fried puddings. I think they're a bit odd. And I think when Glasgow fried a Mars bar, enough was enough. But I think, I'm mad about poaching meat. I think poached chicken's one of my all-time favourite things. And one of the joyous results of poaching meat is this lovely stock and broth that results, of which it seems perfect for making a lovely white sauce with, loaded with parsley and the meat chopped up inside it. And then roll it in pastry and deep fry it, and fried food is so irresistible. It's a very naughty thing indeed.
Well, we had the cuttlefish with wild garlic, dulse, asparagus, and peas.
Oh, good. I'm glad you had that one. It's quite nice.
It was wonderful.
Lots going on.
And even as it was rainy and dreary, it was spring. The food was spring.
Oh, thank you. No, it's lovely. There seems to be a sort of rather nice thing happens when all this lovely produce arrives, and you go in the fridge and there it is scattered around boxes and on the floor waiting to go away, and you go, oh, that could be very nice together. And, you know, there's nice thought processes that put lovely ingredients together, and they're all homage to great old dishes.
Now, you decided...
You know, and they're just tweaked and brought along in some cockamamie way that we like to do things.
Well, you like to put peas with everything, right? So...
I can't resist a pea.
You have to eat your peas.
Peas were in season and lamb sweetbreads were available, so of course we had to have lamb sweetbreads with peas.
Yeah, I love it. And sweetbreads and peas, I absolutely adore. I remember we used to cook them at Alistair Little, which is, gosh, 20, 25 years ago. And it was an amazing dish then. And this is another manifestation of it. I'm moving on. And so it's very nice to keep the ball rolling in the continuous line. I feel it's very important.
Now, listeners, what you have to do is you have to realize that Jeremy is nothing if not inventive.
Yes.
So after
how many years of chefing?
So hold on a second. So you're going to find things on the menu you probably didn't even know existed, but they're delicious. I just noticed, because I think it was at another bistro or brasserie, we saw onglet, which of course is hanger steak, but you've got lamb onglet on your menu, and only because we have a good friend who is a lamb producer right here, and we had a very inventive chef once cooking there, do we know there even is such a thing as a lamb hanger steak. and they're not very big.
They certainly are not. They're toothsome little bites, those are.
I think they're the
original tasty little morsel.
But it's so labor-intensive getting those off of the lamb.
Oh, yeah, no. One of the great, wonderful effects of having our food community and restaurant scene that's burgeoning now is the butchers are coming back with, you know, the quality is just rocketed. And so there's an inventor. I mean, they're as curious and as inventive as the cooks. And so they're constantly finding out new cuts and old cuts that we haven't seen for decades because we've been annihilated by BSE and CJD and foot and mouth and, you know, a lot of forward, meat became a bit almost taboo really at one stage. So it's wonderful that these things are now returning to our menu, and folk are interested and want to eat them and curious and like that, you know, it's a good story. And the butchers are much more amenable now. It's not just a pork chop and a steak. There's lots of wonderful cuts.
Are your butchers in England like the butchers in America? They're all hunks and go shirtless.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Highly. I mean, they look more like blacksmiths.
They sell out all these butchering classes to people who are never going to lift a knife.
It is great fun. It is an extraordinary community of folk now, and they're all very cheeky and no longer look like they've come out of a medieval painting. I mean, they really are, you know, they're rather charming human beings now.
Now, there are things that I didn't have on this menu that I really wish I could come. What are Arbroath Smoky Monk's Beard?
Arbroath
Smoky is, well, Arbroath is a small fishing village up the coast from Dundee on the east coast of Scotland, where I grew up. And it's famous for this particular dish, which is a smoked haddock.
Uh-huh.
And a hot smoked, very fresh. And used to be done in peat, actually, curiously enough.
Yeah.
And they're very, and unlike the herring, which is very fatty and can take a great deal of punishing heat, the Arbroath is the smoky is very delicate. And it's only in the last 5-10 years that they've really begun to travel. Don't know if you can actually get them down south. And so it's a very delicate smoked haddock, which has a particularly nice affinity with monk's beard, which such as that, or barba di frati, or agretti, as they call it in Italy. And it's this lovely sort of tendril of, it's a green sea vegetable, with, which looks terribly beard, you know, it's very sage-like vegetable. It's not a colour of sage, but nothing that strong. And it has a very delicacy, and it's a great foil for powerful, potent smoked fish flavours and cured fish, which all work very well together. So it makes a very lovely salad. Again, this one has a bit more butter on it than it should probably, but we can't resist butter, really.
Well, you couldn't resist bringing over some dishes from Blueprint Cafe as well, because I seem to remember the smoked eel and horseradish sandwich.
It was wonderful.
Yes.
And that came over. And the baked salsify came over.
Lovely things. It is very interesting what did and did not translate in passage. Some stuff you just said, oh, Lord, no, those dishes are very jealous. You know, it should remain there as a happy memory. And then some just seemed very, very prevalent and obvious. Well, and I'm glad you got the smoked eel, because it's the last days of the smoked eel, because the fish campaigners and the great concerns over the fish supplies. And the Sargasso Sea it remains such a complete mystery. The eel is becoming a big no-no now.
Oh, no, so, is it really?
Yeah, it's very sad. We're very upset about it. So, I mean, we were just buying 4 or 5 a week, but that's 4 or 5 too many.
Well,
you had one of the very last ones of the dear smoked eel numbers.
No, I thought you were...
Well, what we have got, there's some amazing... there's one door closes, another opens, obviously. There's an amazing brown trout that's suddenly come to the fore as all these, you know, and out of necessity and frugality comes inventiveness. And bingo, this delicious smoked brown trout has suddenly started appearing, which seems presumptive to the smoked eel. Which is just quite funny.
Presumptive to smoke.
Now, can't you get freshwater eel from Lancashire or somewhere like that?
Well, this is our lovely friend Karen, up at the Dutch Eel Company, who we've worked with for years and years and years and have been our sole suppliers, and they are about as right on as you can get. And I think what we're all having to do at this stage now is really just put our heads together and be assured that all that we're doing is as correct as possible. And any grey areas. So we're in the process, and hopefully this little hiatus will not be for very long, so we can be assured that all the produce we handle is as lovely as we'd like it to be.
Now, give us a little bit of background information on Quo Vadis before we let you go back to staffing your kitchen. We understand you're interviewing new chefs today, so we better let you go back.
Army is now having to be formed for here. It was open at the original buildings. It's 4 London townhouses. The Georgian, the one Victorian, numbers 26 to 29 Dean Street in Soho, London, W1. And a man called Leone, or Peppino, rather, who wrote this rather remarkable book called I Will Die on the Carpet. And I said, well, mine will be I'll Die in the Kitchen, probably.
You made that up, Jeremy.
I'm afraid not. It's absolutely bona fides on that. I'm absolutely going to 100% do. I will die on the carpet, really, honestly. We haven't got any carpet. Well, it's a bit mysterious, I suppose. He was a rather remarkable man who, in the last days of friend, I think Soho was an enormous Italian community.
Now, what I wanted to ask was, for you to go through what times you're open, because you're open on Saturdays and Sundays, but with a different menu, which is somewhat unusual for restaurants in your part of London. So that's the
Yeah, absolutely. We're closed on Sunday at the moment. On Saturday, we keep... we're open Monday through Saturday now. But Sunday, strangely, don't work for us yet. That is waiting to happen. Yeah. And will be changed. And we do breakfast, lunch and dinner and coffee and tea. We're blessed with our own bakery and an amazing baker called Carol, who we love very much.
Who's working
wonders with sourdough and rye, which is amazing.
And in between meals, people just hang out in a bar.
Yep, there's a lovely bar. There's an outside terrace on Dean Street, so it's a lovely sunny evening tonight. So there'll be lots of muscadet mussels and chips. And smoked eel for soaked fish sandwiches and nibbling on good things.
Now, what is the difference in your clientele since you've moved into Quo Vadis? It has to be a different clientele. Or do people just follow you around?
Well, there's a lot of people, which is incredibly generous, who said, oh, we always wanted to come and see you at the Blueprint, but it was so far away and it was so remote and we never got to you. And the lovely thing about being in Soho is it is literally right bang in the centre of London. So it's a perfect meeting place for thoughts, because you're right in the heart of the film business and were then referred by agents and editors. There's a remarkable sort of film and theatre and art crowd that is rather, is wonderful, rather the backbone. And the real backbone of Corvallis of friends and family, all about folks feeling they're in the right place for the right reasons. And, you know, I mean, I think we're, you know, reviews are gorgeous, but we're only as good as the folk who keep returning to us and keep coming.
Now, each one of these menus has a very enigmatic little drawing on it. What is that about?
It certainly does.
I'm looking at the one, here's a mermaid with some guy and a couple seashells and big...
Yeah, the whole there's a wonderful man called Julian Roberts who helped very much to shape the menu physically. And he had an illustrator up his sleeve who he'd been wanting to work with for years and years and years called John Broderick. And the timing and lighting could be not more conducive and more lovely at the time. So he brilliantly came on board and started doing the illustrations for us. Because we said, oh, let's not have photography, let's have drawings. And because my father's an illustrator and it seemed all very pertinent at the time. And he went off like a rocket. I mean, he was unstoppable. It was just drawing after drawing after drawing came away under his pen. It was amazing. And he just got it, absolutely, what it was we were trying to do and wanted to do and where we wanted to go. So we're amassing some extraordinary archive of these amazing illustrations.
Which
celebrate, you know, each ingredient as it comes in, and smoked eel, there's the bakery, there's the kipper, there are both smokies, there's one with a man sticking into a barrel, and they are very, very funny.
Well, all the stars are aligned at Quo Vadis, including you, my favorite star, Jeremy.
Bless you, my love.
So
thank you.
Much continued success to you, and hopefully see you again soon, huh?
Yes, please. Sooner would be better. Lovely. Thanks so very much, you both. Love you both very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with an old favorite with a new twist right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, when you're in London, you will, of course, go to Borough Market. It's so exciting when it's open to the public on weekends.
Along with everybody else in London, it seems
exactly.
like, by the way.
And you can get, actually, takeout from a stand in Borough Market from this restaurant called Roast. But the great fun is actually going into the restaurant. It's probably one of the buzziest places in town, I think.
It is, and it's a beautiful space, views on all sides down to the market itself, but at the same time you're away from that hustle and bustle, only to be surrounded by the hurly-burly of a very, very busy restaurant. And a new chef at the helm this year, been there just a little bit more than a year, and not afraid to change things.
Although
Roast is really still a very traditional British menu. The new chef, Marcus Verbini, has certainly not been afraid to make changes. And, of course, you'll hear about that right after we play this interview.
It's actually late afternoon, actually almost dinner time. And if you could note the noise in the background, at Roast in Borough Market, this restaurant is still buzzing, popping, and we're talking to their wonderful chef, who we just met, although you've been here for what?
Since January 1st, 2012, just about 16 months or so.
And now, Marcus Verbeeren, did I do that?
That was perfect.
He reminds me once again that there's some kind of a genetic predisposition among New Zealanders, Kiwis, to be fabulous cooks. And so here we are.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Now, we've been to Roast before. You have access to probably the best supply of product around.
Yeah, it is great to be on the market. We do source a lot of sort of things outside the market also from all around the UK. All our beef, hand-dived scallops, all got great waters around the UK for any sort of seafood up around Scotland where the water's lovely and clean. There's a lot going on up there. Yeah, we're blessed. We're blessed in the UK.
Well, you really left New Zealand, although you started cooking there, because you wanted to travel. and see the world. This is what a lot of young chefs want to do. How much have you seen?
Well, I started cooking in New Zealand. I was there for about 2 years, then moved to Melbourne. But I didn't really see a lot of Australia. I was in Melbourne for about a year and a half cooking, then came to the UK in 2001. So initially, when I first came over, I was sort of planning to be here maybe 3 years or so, but I'm lucky because I've got a Dutch passport through my father's ancestry. And I've been here 14 years now, so once I got here, I couldn't really turn around and go back. But I have done a bit of travelling since I've been here. I've done a lot of sort of travel around Europe and that sort of thing, which has been a real eye-opener.
Tell us about some of your travels. What places do you really like culinarily?
I love, it's got to begin with Spain. I think Spain is phenomenal. Their ethos on food, the way, you know, their whole lifestyle is, there's so much culture based around food and eating and with good friends and that sort of thing. Italy as well. Italy's phenomenal. I did a lot of Italian cooking when I was in Melbourne, so I'm really keen on that side of things too. And France as well. But all around Europe, there's fantastic food. I spent a couple of weeks in driving around Czech Republic as well, and the food over there is great too. Croatia's got a really good food, and I love Greek food as well. I spent a bit of time in Greece. I love the way the Greeks eat.
That's really the only time in my life I've been really fat. I mean, I agree. Food is all good.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's wonderful. It's so simple. Just simple food, really nice olive oils, and it's wonderful. I love it. Lots of lamb.
I love lamb, and that's probably why I liked it. What I liked also is they always let you look at your food before they gave it to you. You could check it out before it was served.
Yeah.
Now, here you are, and as I said, we've been to Rose quite a lot. You took over a kitchen that was pretty well established. How did you put your own personal imprint onto it, and what dishes could we look to see that?
When I came here, the restaurant was already very well established. It'd been open for 6 years, had a great reputation. Lawrence did, and Iqbal had done a fantastic job of setting it up and getting it heaving, full of business and customers. It's great being on the market. When I got here in early last year, January 1st last year, 2012, a chef coming into a new kitchen, I just wanted to change everything as quickly as I could. So, you don't want to come in here and be cooking the previous chef's food. So I changed things and a few systems and got my sort of style on the menu as well as soon as I got there. There are a few staples that are still on there, sort of dishes like our roast pork belly with mashed potatoes and Bramley apple sauce. Now, if I took that off, there'd be a riot kind of thing. So I had to, I left quite a few bits and bobs on the menu, but I changed most of it in January. The January we reopened after the week's refurbishment. I had a nice new cooking range to start off with. And then February, the rest of the menu changed.
Are you still serving the wonderful fish and chips in the Financial Times replica?
Yes, we are. That's something it's on the a la carte. It wasn't on the a la carte when I first started here. Every now and then it was on as a special on a Friday. But yeah, I've changed that and it's gone on to the a la carte.
You mentioned your style. Could you expound on that a little bit? What do you view as your particular personality in food?
When it comes to writing my menu, I just get on the phone to my suppliers and I say, what's coming in, what's going out? Nature has a great sort of knack, great sort of food pairings, natural food pairings. It's a matter of just getting on the phone to the suppliers, seeing what's coming in, what's going out, getting that list of ingredients, and then just working from that. Menu's very much supplier driven. We've got a lot of great suppliers and more coming through and around the UK, different farmers, different vegetable growers, artisan cheese companies and that sort of thing as well. So it's just a matter of getting everything together that's available, just doing your menu that way. So it's a nice night that you've got a nice balance. And I try to just work out, use what great produce we have and not do too much to it. Keep it nice and simple. If I had to describe the food at Roast, I'd describe it as simple food, well executed.
Your ultimate boss, Iqbal, I guess he's a longtime friend of On the Menu. We have sat and lunched with him several times here. And for all his name that is clearly not English, he's a traditionalist in many ways, and that tradition still continues. So if people are looking for a traditional roast of some kind with potatoes, Jersey Royals, I notice are on the menu today. I guess they must be just in season again. These things are going to be there. One of the more interesting things about your program altogether is the wine program, which has a heavy emphasis on English wines. Are you in a position to comment on that?
I think that English are producing some fantastic wines at the moment, especially there's a lot of really good sparkling English sparkling wines.
That's a result of climate change, they say.
Yeah, that's right. There's a vein of chalk running through Champagne that runs straight down through the sort of south of, sort of through Kent and through the south of the UK as well. And with climate change and global warming, as the climate warms up, you've got that chalk running through that through where Champagne is, that same vein running all the way through. So with the climate change, the weather's getting a little bit warmer here as well, which likens it to Champagne too. So in a few years' time, and already we're getting that ideal climate for growing Champagne grapes.
It's amazing, but all the historic buildings aren't air-conditioned here anyhow.
Now, I did want to put in a note here, and I'll ask you to contradict me if you think I'm wrong, but we did hear that a number of British winemakers, including some of the top sparkling winemakers, said, we will not make a wine in 2012. So, listeners, watch out for this. If you think you're wine smart and somebody serves you a 2012 British wine, might either be not very good or it might be a fake.
Yeah, 2012 wasn't the best for the growers, that's for sure.
Now, again, I said to you, why is it every time I come here, and I restrain myself this trip for lunch, as I had only one order of oysters. And they're not all the same. I mean, these are different ones from what we usually get, but why are they so wonderful here?
The oysters in the UK, there's a great history of oysters in the UK, going back to Victorian times. London, oysters were in Victorian times were like peasant sort of food. London along the Thames was dotted with oyster and porterhouses. And so we've got that. There's just fantastic oysters growing around here. When the Romans settled in Colchester, they brought a lot of oysters with them as well. And that's where it comes from as well. There's a lot of sort of native oysters that are grown around Colchester. And they've done research and they've found in Roman ruins in Italy, traces in the ruins of the actual oyster shells from that Colchester region. So because the Italians used to sail back to Italy with a net dragging the oysters behind them, filtering them as they go, cleaning them out as they go, so they get then take them back to Italy with them. Yeah, still alive.
In addition to the oysters I had, I took advantage of the season and got these great steamed fat asparagus on the menu with hollandaise sauce, and I was very, very good. Like, I was trying to cut down on caloric intake, so I requested the hollandaise on the side, but asparagus themselves were beautifully bathed in butter, I believe, and they were yummy. I ate every one of them.
Yeah, we're in the peak of the asparagus season, and I don't think there's anywhere in the world that grows asparagus quite like UK asparagus.
Why?
I'm not sure. I don't know if it's the fact that it doesn't travel very well, and the asparagus that we're getting is grown much closer by, and it doesn't have as far to travel. I'm not sure. I suppose you just put it down to it's a good climate, and farmers know what they're doing. They've been doing it for years and years, and the soil. There's a lot of really good fertile soil in the UK as well.
I have to say, these were fat, but they were perfectly, perfectly cooked. They were just brilliant. Thank you. Made my day. And we also had, you have a number of very interesting salmon dishes on the menu. Now, what one did we have? We had it with pickled cucumbers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's one of a dish I came up with last year. I'm a great fan in the summertime of a gin and tonic. And so I came up with this idea of doing this gin-cured salmon, but putting a little bit of lime zest in it as well, and curing it with some juniper in there as well. So in the cure mix itself, you've got your usuals, your salt and your sugar for the curing. Some gin in there as well. Perfect sort of thing. I mean, you can bear aside at home and it'll last a couple of weeks in your fridge kind of thing. And it's great to pull out and have a few slices out in the sun.
I'll do that when I get home. Now, I want you to tell us, I mean, I'm in love with Jersey Royal potatoes. Tell us a little bit about them.
I'm definitely with you on that. I think they're the best. Whenever I put them on the menu, I say to the waiters, these are quite possibly the best potatoes in the world. I absolutely adore them. They've got such a phenomenal flavour.
But it's because of the soil, the climate, everything, terroir.
Well, I mean, Jersey Island itself, a lot of the time they get the seaweed and they cover the soil with the seaweed, which fills the soil back full of nutrients, so they can use that same soil over and over again. It's looking after the land. And the seaweed actually bakes in the sun and heats up the ground as well. So that's sort of bringing the potatoes on, so you can get them quite early as well.
Some other dish you would like to highlight out of this? I guess we're in the spring menu, though, but some other dish you'd like to, that really expresses your interests a lot.
There's a couple of dishes that are my personal favourites at the moment. We've got this lightly cured salmon dish that we also do with char-grilled asparagus, and we make this dressing out of a reduction of orange juice with some honey and some grain mustard through it, and we serve that with a little bit of creme fraiche. It's a really nice light starter. And you get that barbecue flavour from the char grill coming through the asparagus nicely. There's also, we've got Cornish lamb sweetbreads at the moment with, we have this sort of lovely white sprouting broccoli.
White?
Yeah, white sprouting broccoli.
Never saw it.
Yeah, it's just got a little white floret on it. It was more of like a goldeny colour, but they call it white sprouting broccoli as opposed to your purple. And
it's different from broccoli rabe.
It's actually a lot more tender than the purple sprouting broccoli. The stalk itself, it's almost as tender as asparagus. It's absolutely divine.
Next time I have to try that.
And we do that with anchovies and capers. It's like a little savoury. It's lovely.
I'm sorry I didn't have that. Sounds heavenly.
We also have this, I've got a fantastic scallop supplier up on the Isle of Mull who I go up and visit every now and then. He takes me out in his boat and he goes diving and comes up with his bounty. And we're doing his scallops at the moment with a celery and apple and golden raisin coleslaw with a few toasted hazelnuts on top. So the menu's quite light at this time of year, you know. We're trying to lighten things up because people want to eat a little bit healthier at this time of year, I find.
You're so smart. Really just have put a lot of thought into this, and you can tell. And I wanted to mention, by the way, that I don't think we've ever talked about it before, but the service here is really wonderful. The people you've hired, they have personality, and they're trained beautifully, and they're very considerate. So we like service here a lot, too.
Let's deal with the important thing, which is where to make a reservation, because that's highly recommended, especially on days when the Borough Market is open. But I think you also open for breakfast on some days of the week. The website, if I recall, is roastrestaurant.co.uk, so you can go there. But if you're listening to it right now, Marcus, why don't you just go over the hours you're open?
We do breakfast Monday through until Saturday. We're not open for breakfast on Sunday. Breakfast starts at 8 o'clock. At 7 o'clock and runs through until 11. Then we open for lunch at 12. Quick handover from breakfast to lunch service in the kitchen. Then we're open from 12 until 4 for lunch.
Just out of curiosity, how many covers? How many meals do you serve at any one of these times?
Well, Saturday would be our busiest day. Saturday's mayhem. Because the market's open and the market's absolutely rammed shoulder to shoulder. Last Saturday, actually, we broke a few records. We did 260-odd for breakfast, and then we rolled into a 290-cover lunch, and then about 180, 200 for dinner kind of thing on a Saturday. Saturday's pretty manic.
Wow. Well, we enjoy it. We keep coming back, and I look forward to the next trip. I want some more of that stuff that you've been talking about. I missed the sweetbreads. Too bad. Next time, Marcus, wonderful meeting you as well. Thank you.
And we'll be back with another old favorite with a new chef at the helm right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again. We seem to have a fixation for this program on chefs named Marcus, because here's another Marcus, Marcus Eves, at a most wonderful, exquisite restaurant called Pied-à-Terre.
Yeah, an old favorite that somehow never gets old.
No.
And seems to be seamless as to who's in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Starting out with, I think, David Moore, who's the owner, then Tom Akins, then Shane Osborne, and now Marcus Eves, who worked with both of those fine gentlemen and is now putting his own stamp on Pied-à-Terre, having spent the last 2 years before coming back to Pied-à-Terre at L'Autre-Pied, another place that we love. Yeah. But back to Pied-à-Terre, and for a serene and wonderful dinner.
It's always great to revisit places that you've enjoyed and loved, actually, in the past, and to reconnect with people, in this case, chefs, a chef, Marcus Eves, that we've known for a while in different capacities. You, at first, you were here as a sous chef,
yes,
and then you were at L'Entrepied as the chef, and now you're back here at the Pied à Terre as the executive chef.
As the chef, exactly, yeah. It's amazing, really.
How many years is this now?
I've been back here now for coming up to 2 years, as the chef. But I've been in the company now for nearly 9 years.
Nine years. That's amazing.
So it's great. It's fantastic. Nice to be back as well, you know. Yeah.
Well, tell me this. I like to get caught up. I mean, what's different now about... let's say what's different about Pied à Terre, because that's where we are.
About Pied à Terre, I mean, really, there's been some changes with the food and the menu, and obviously bringing on my style is evolving. But so there's a nice sort of synergy as well, and sort of similarity to where Shane's food was previously as well, because Shane was really my mentor.
I mean, I guess what we ought to do is just mention that in all this process, that it was Shane Osborne who was running the show for a long time.
Yeah.
And he left, and he's now, you said, in Singapore.
That's in Asia.
But you have had plenty of time, I think, to imprint your own style in this place.
Yeah, that's it. I think what's happened is, I think over time as well, restaurants are changing. The style of food in general is changing.
So isn't that true?
Things are becoming a little bit more natural anyway. I think 10 years ago, some chefs would buy a cheap carrot and see how many tricks they could do with the carrot, as opposed to buy the best carrot and just cook it, you know, simply and make sure that it's perfect. So I think that's...
find out, by the way, and I mean, I guess I should ask.
Rennie Redzepi.
We'll get talks about this 2-year carrot that's been in the ground for 2 years. Why does this thing not rot, especially in Scandinavia, in Copenhagen?
I'd have to ask Rennie. I have not got a clue. I don't know. No, I don't know.
Maybe it doesn't rot because the ground freezes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a thought. Yeah. I
remember Shane telling us when we talked to him. And we asked him, how do you get fresh ideas and how do you get new things? And he said, the neat part about it is we have a name. People know us. So they come to us and say, I have this new stuff. Wouldn't you like to try it? Is that still happening?
It's so true. Yes. Yeah. With regards to all the suppliers, they're always constant. We're really lucky. We are really lucky because we're getting constant suppliers coming to us, new suppliers, but also the network of suppliers we've already got are constantly bringing in new ingredients, new spices, new products, whether it be vegetables or different kinds of flours. And we just got last week some hazelnut flour, so some ground hazelnuts.
Yeah,
and we,
good stuff.
It's amazing. You know, we just started to try and we're testing at the moment to make a gnocchi recipe with
wonderful
hazelnut flour. It's just taking old dishes, revamping them, reinventing them, and just try to modernize them, refine them, and keep moving forward like that, really.
When you said that your style is evolving, could you be more specific about that? What's happening?
I think it's really difficult to say because, I mean, it just, what happens is when we dress the plates and we put on a new dish and we keep changing the dish until it feels right. So it's really, really difficult because we don't taste the food and as in a whole dish as much as we should. But yeah, just keep moving until a dish feels right. And once we've nailed it and we've got that dish 100%, we're happy with it, then it goes on the menu and then we go with it like that, really. So
do you write down the recipe and then say, now you have to make it according to the recipe?
Yes, yeah, exactly. We do, actually. We're working more and more like that purely because it's so difficult. You know, every time we do a recipe, the recipe's logged. Or we've got a good sort of database of recipes now and they're all logged. And it's all put down, and any changes that are made, we may change the recipe again after that.
Here's an interesting thought from Rene, less than a person, a luminary, shall we say, even though he's now only the second best restaurant in the world. Rene Redzepi said very boldly, with I think a couple of F-bombs included, that recipes were evil.
Really?
That really all you needed was a guideline. Yeah, I know, and then you had to go from there.
Take photographs as well.
Not too many photographs, really, because we do want the food to still be very natural, you know. And then certain things do change at the time. There may be a set recipe for again going back to the carrot puree, but certain times of the year the carrots are sweeter than others. So obviously they are a guideline, but we have to have something in place for new members of staff, like almost like frame to work with.
Now, I mean, your primary influence started out as French, but you're more Maud Britt now, aren't you?
I think so. I mean, it's really, really difficult to... I had this at over at Lotrop when we first opened. A lot of the journalists were trying to put us in a certain box. It's really, really difficult, but we do pasta, we do pasta dishes, we try to source as many ingredients from the UK as possible, but at the same time, if we can get some white asparagus from Le Londe in France and it's better, then we'll go with the best product, really. So that's what it comes down to, really, is just trying to use the best product.
Now, what you have a manageable size restaurant.
Yes, yeah.
And you have a well-trained staff. Managed to develop a lot of loyalty to your staff. So you don't have a great deal of turnover, right?
No, that's it. I mean, now we're very fortunate. I mean, being back here 2 years now, a lot of the guys are coming up to being here a year to 18 months. And myself, when I was working here previously, a lot of the team were here 2-3 years. Especially a great environment to work in, especially being a new building now again since the fire. It's fantastic. So yeah, we are very lucky in that respect.
Now, I think everything is changing very rapidly in the whole food, and food is culture and restaurant scene. It's coming at you very quickly. I mean, how do you respond? You just let yourself go and explore all the new developments that are hitting?
Yeah, I think it's really, really to keep your eyes open and to not to fall into that trap of being a touch narrow-minded or just doing what you do and just, you know, you have to be sort of explore what's new and what's out there. I mean, it is really, really important, especially I try to eat out as much as possible. So it is, I think it becomes basically when you see and you keep in touch with what's happening out there in the industry, it's very easy to go with it and to just roll with what's going on. I think if as a chef you don't eat out and you don't explore, then it would be very difficult as well to keep up with what's happening.
What are some of the most major changes that you see that you're really excited about?
For me, it's just about produce, full stop, really. It is about produce. It's some of the stuff that we get, some of the products we get in at the moment are amazing. Some of the morel mushrooms. I mean, St. George mushrooms are fantastic at the moment.
Where do you get the morels? Well,
never even heard of St. George.
St. George, exactly, yeah. We are getting some from the UK at the moment, but the season is 2 weeks. So that is it. 2 week season on the menu. And you know, you've got them for 2 weeks, so you need to get them on as many dishes or as many specials or tasting menus as possible, and then they're gone till next year. So
are we lucky tonight?
You are, actually. We've got some.
Really?
Yeah, we've got some. Yes, yeah. Yeah, we've got some delivered this morning. I'm told they're possibly the last delivery. So.
Oh, that's exciting.
2 weeks. Mm.
Now, Anne gets very excited about morels. Now, are they native to the UK?
No, they're not. No, they're
coming from
between France and Turkey, depending on the time of year. But again, the morel season can be 5 to 6 weeks long. So as long as you stick to the seasons and the seasonality, cooking's so exciting because there's always something new. And then you've always got that in the back of your mind. There's always the dishes that you did last year that you've got as a good point of reference. And then you get to refine them and move forward again. So, brilliant.
Well, we talk about products a lot. But, I mean, certainly one of the biggest revolutions has to be things that work in the kitchen, things that affect technique.
Yes.
And
yeah.
all these kitchens now have their standard toys in all these kitchens.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Some of the Scandinavian chefs are throwing them out and just relying on an open fire to cook and not doing all the other stuff. What do you have in your kitchen? Do you have sous vide things? And do you
we do have all that kind of stuff. I think it is a must, really, for a kitchen, modern kitchen. But at the same time, it's in moderation, really, to be quite honest. I think we use the water baths and packer jets and all those pieces of equipment we're talking about. But at the same time, we don't let the chefs and you know, you can't forget how to cook a saddle of lamb on the bone. It'd be horrible if we forgot to or we didn't know anymore how to cook a piece of turbot on the bone. It would be that would be terrible. So what we do is we use all the modern techniques and we use all this equipment, but in moderation, we make sure that we don't really cook all the meat or all the fish in the water bath and things like that. So I think it's important, really, to have a mix.
Yeah, I love Thomas Keller's book on sous vide, called Cooking Under Pressure, because he breaks it down. There are some things that just shouldn't be cooked like that.
Period.
And other things that taste better that way.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that's the most important thing, is to work out how you can use it to play to your strength. Once you've got that, then it's fantastic.
Now, let's talk about your customers. Who comes to Pied à Terre?
I think we were very fortunate, really. I mean, we get the normal sort of business crowd. We get a lot of people coming for special occasions, birthdays, anniversary, and things like that.
So that's sort of continuing. I remember Shane and David said that indeed Pied à Terre is a special occasion restaurant.
It is, very much so, yeah. I mean, we get, I would say, I mean, even at lunchtime today, we had two tables in birthdays. There very rarely goes a service by where it's not somebody's birthday or anniversary.
The funniest thing is we arrived at 4:30 to talk to you, and the lunch crowd is still here. Do you actually have to throw them out?
We'll get to that, especially on a Friday lunch. We're pretty much fully booked most Fridays. It's great as taking an extended lunch, relaxing, enjoying it, and that's what we're here for as well.
There were happy, smiling faces down there got here. Now, tell us about a couple of the things aside from the St. George's mushrooms. They're going to have us have happy, smiling faces tonight when we're done.
Yep. Yeah, I mean,
you want to look at this, or can you remember?
No, I should be all right. Yeah. No, I've got the two dishes, actually, that have been on the menu. Pretty much the first dishes I put on the menu when I came back is, one is the quail salad, which is with a small quail Kiev. So it's based on the chicken Kiev, really, but it's
quail
Kiev? Yeah, it's a mini quail Kiev filled with some garlic butter, and then the quail breasts and some salad and dandelion and some leaves like that.
Oh, I love dandelion.
It's lovely. It's a really nice, fresh dish. Lots of bursts of acidity and things like that. It's really, really nice. And then there's a monkfish dish as well, which we cook with some blackened spices. Lots of sort of curry, fenugreek, or fennel seeds and things like that. They've been cooked out really, really slow, so they turn sort of very dark. And that's cooked with some sort of Moroccan spices.
Have you ever seen a fish uglier than a monkfish?
Not really. No. That's it.
Have you ever seen one that's more overrated?
Yeah. There's Patagonian,
Patagonian toothfish.
Yeah, that's pretty ugly,
otherwise known as Chilean sea bass.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
That's another ugly bugger in the ocean.
Oh, is it really?
Oh, yes.
So continue. What other dishes?
And then we have a milfoy on the desserts, which to be honest, those three dishes pretty much stay on. And the milfoy we really change to do with the seasons. Next week we're actually putting the milfoy on with some wild straw, but at the moment we've got it just it's at the tail end of the season with the pears. So we've got pear and cinnamon milfoy with some panda piece ice cream, so some spiced bread ice cream.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's lovely. Really, really nice. So.
Now, there's some white asparagus in there too, I'll bet.
Yes, that's it. Yes, yeah. It's funny because we got the white asparagus is with ham we were speaking about earlier. Yeah, some Tanigra ham in there.
Oh, fabulous.
So,
okay.
Yeah, with a little bit of crab mayonnaise, so a little bit of sort of almost like surf and turf there as well,
It's like a little play on words there.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. So, I think, You're in for a treat, I think. I hope, anyway.
I think it sounds pretty good to me.
I'm sure in for a treat, and we thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us between lunch and dinner service. I think we've taken the whole time there is, so we better let you go back to the kitchen, and we'll see you again during the dinner hour, I'm sure.
Excellent.
Thank you, my pleasure.
A family meal? We call it family meal, your staff meal.
We try to. Start it on the Saturdays, because Saturday is the only real day that we get sort of, it's a bit more chilled out. On Saturday we have sort of, the guys have the music on in the kitchen, it's very sort of relaxed, because we're closed on Saturday lunch. Guys tend to come a little bit earlier, take their time with their preparation and things like that. It's a bit more of a sort of social day, and sit down at sort of 3 o'clock, family meal, and then get ready for the evening, so... we don't at the moment. I mean, we do all sort of eat together, but we don't sit down as such. It's so difficult when we've got fully booked for lunch, fully booked for dinner. It's quite tough to find the time, unfortunately, yeah.
And please give our regards to David.
Yes, I will, yeah.
We're delighted to reconnect with him, and so pleased to know that things are going well. And who knows what the future will hold, but I'm sure our paths will cross again.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Cheers.
Great, Marcus. Thank you.
And right after the break, we'll take a step out of London for a special excursion, which we'll tell you about right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And where are we now, Rabideau?
Well, it turned out that for reasons which are not important to the program, we did make an excursion out of London, a couple of hundred miles to the north, to one of England's most beautiful towns, the beautiful town of Harrogate, which until relatively recently didn't have a fine dining restaurant. And that's where Tom Van Zeller fits in. And just in case you're wondering, there is actually a link to the previous interview, because David Moore, who owns Pied à Terre, knows Tom Van Zeller very well, since he used to work at Pied à Terre, and David's actually an investor in his restaurant, a charming spot in the very center of a very charming town. So here's Tom.
We've been having this really wonderful conversation with Tom Van Zeller. We were not quite sure exactly why we were here, except that very dear friends of ours, very talented chefs and restaurateurs, insisted that if we're going north in England, we had to go to Harrogate, which is where we are, and we're experiencing the talent of Tom's restaurant. Tom, were you surprised to see us? I mean, we didn't even know we were coming, and here we are.
Yeah, here we are indeed, yeah. Well, I'm very glad to meet you. Welcome to Harrogate, welcome to Yorkshire. A nice little detour, I think, and I hope that we can talk about some interesting topics about my restaurant here. Lots of different experiences have led me to create a restaurant that I feel that I can put my own name to, and I feel very happy with where we are now, having had 4 years' worth of successful business here in my hometown of Harrogate, North Yorkshire.
And, of course, Harrogate is this wonderful, beautiful city. I always think of it with all the wonderful flowers planted around. And I remember when our son Adam was 4 years old, we bought him his first, whatever that coat's called, a duffel coat, which actually he wasn't all that thrilled to wear to school. I mean, nobody held it a duffel coat. But anyhow, your restaurant is called Van Zeller?
Yes, Van Zeller, my name, my surname. Yeah.
And you were of Dutch origin, but you were a born and bred Yorkshireman.
It is a Dutch name. It went from Holland to Portugal in the 1600s through trade, and then diplomatically it came back to the UK, or came to the UK in the 1800s when the council from Portugal married an English girl. And we still have cousins in Portugal who produce in the Douro Valley, both white, red, and obviously port, which we have here at the restaurant.
That's amazing. You have all these little secrets you let out gradually to us. The concept of the restaurant you're going to tell us about, but before that, you have such a rich history of experience in the culinary field. Tell us a little bit. How did you start cooking, and where have you been?
Well, you're right. I started at a young age within food. My mother was a home economics teacher at the local high school. So food was very much a part of everyday life, fresh food, whether it be preparing, eating or cleaning up. It was a part of day to day. So it's something I've always been used to, and something I've always found myself drawn to and naturally happy with and comfortable in those sorts of surroundings, I suppose. So as I went through school and took home economics, I then took a part-time evening job and weekend job at a place called Betty's, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, because Betty's has become a global brand, and they have wonderful cafes here in North Yorkshire that produce fantastic traditional English teas. And in fact, you can buy their products through a different company name called Taylor's, and that's available by post, etc. So anyway, because I did that, I got into working in a commercial kitchen, and that company looked after their staff, and they were really helpful in my early career, and they sent me on to work at a country house hotel, more of a conference and banqueting place, but they sent me to college one day a week to do food preparation and cookery. And through that, I got work experience at Le Manoir Quatre Saisons, Raymond Blanc, a famed restaurant in Oxfordshire. And during that 3 week stage period, they were opening Le Petit Blanc, a brasserie concept chain of restaurants. The first one was opening in Oxford. I was asked to be part of that opening team, and I duly accepted at the age of 19 to do that. So moving away from home, working for Raymond Blanc's company was a really big deal, and I was beginning to fulfill my career ambitions.
But were you just sort of enthralled with French cooking then, or had you already figured out that you had something to contribute to the British food scene?
I was just enjoying the work. I felt comfortable working in the kitchens, but I didn't feel that I was contributing. I was very young and naive to a certain degree, but I was learning my way and learning good people, and I was learning very quickly.
But you had more than one really, like, outstanding, knock-your-socks-off mentor and colleague. This has to brush the idea of being a really very creative, successful chef has to have been something that entered your mind at an early age.
It certainly was, yes. It was probably in my second position within my career, and I picked up a copy of White Heat. It was the paperback version, so there was no photography, but it was the quotes and the power of those words that I was just drawn to. It was as if it was like a streets were paved with gold moment. I just felt I had to get to London to work in a hardcore Michelin kitchen to fulfill whatever it was inside me that was pushing me along. And that's what led me to Oxford and then down to London 8 months later to Pied-à-Terre, where Tom Aitkins had just kept hold of his second Michelin star. And the whole industry had just gone, really? Who's this guy? And a lot of press was generated from that amazing achievement that he'd done with David Moore, and I wanted to be a part of that, so I took the opportunity to get on the bus to London and go and work there for a day, and I was offered a job pretty much on the spot. I had a holiday booked to New York with a couple of pals, which I took, like a long weekend. It was over St. Patrick's Day, I recall. Got back and started work at Pied-à-Terre, which was hardcore to say the least. But
well, this is actually that our connection to you is David Moore and Pied-à-Terre and so forth and so on. When did you figure out what your individual philosophy of food, ideas about what you wanted in a restaurant, when did you figure that out?
Still figuring it out, I think, to a certain degree. Because my restaurant is very progressive. We're always learning, always looking, always listening as a whole team, pushing one another along. I guess at the end of the day, we're providing a service. So it's our customers who have provided us with our unique place in the market. But to try and answer your question, I did have that vision that there was a market to be created. I did feel that Harrogate did deserve a fine dining restaurant. It certainly didn't have one before, and we still are the only fine dining restaurant in Harrogate. So how that's happened, I don't really know. It's just been a very long, progressive amount of hard work.
But you see this as specific to a place. I mean, do you see that everything's going on around you? London is, like, seething with new ideas. How do you fit into that whole scene?
It's difficult to fit into the London scene because we're in a provincial town. To a certain degree, it is to our disadvantage and means that we have to work an awful lot harder to fill what is a humble dining room on a daily basis, 5-6 days a week. We have to work very, very hard to do that in a town that is much smaller than London, that doesn't have as much competition around it, drawing people here. So but in order for us to be abreast of the London scene, which is so critical in the international trade that we're looking at here, it has meant that I have to use the experience I gained when I worked in London, but more importantly, I had to visit London on a regular basis, work in other people's kitchens and get a feel for what they're doing. I don't sit in a dining room and have a three-course meal and get to taste three courses. I work in the kitchen and I'll see the entire menu, lunch menu, a la carte menu, tasting if I'm lucky, and I'll see its preparation and I'll see its management and I will see its execution and its delivery. So I get to see an awful lot more. It's very broad, and that experience is very important to help to keep me at the coalface of the industry, because otherwise I have to rely on photographs and magazines and on the internet. So it's very important for us to stay abreast, because this is a business. We are commercial. And I have developed an ethos within this restaurant, which is that we have to have a new dish every week.
Really?
We never, ever repeat it. And
that's extraordinary, Tom. Really?
What we aim to do is use our provenance. I'm a very proud Yorkshireman. I love it round here. The countryside is fabulous. And it produces some wonderful ingredients, whether it be the East Coast, which is very, very long in Yorkshire. It's a big county. We've got the moorland. We've got the dales. We've got a lot of arable farmland. There's a huge amount of game produced here in the autumn. And it's just wonderful. So what we do is we work very, very closely with our local suppliers. We won't just use something just because it's local, but if it's good enough, then we'll use it. So we use our local suppliers to bring that into the kitchen. We'll go, great, let's do something with this, but let's not do what we did last year. So we'll look at different flavour combinations. We'll look at different textures. We'll absolutely look at new presentation, and we'll perhaps introduce a new technical element. It might be the way that we cook it, or it might be the use of a new ingredient that might be a manipulated ingredient, like lecithin or something like that, just for example, so that we can keep the business moving forward and progress it. And we do that with a new dish each week, and we'll never go back to it. It's not allowed.
Now, we're going to come back to discuss it, I think, with your chef de cuisine, the individual menu item. Before I let you go, you were so much a Yorkshireman. I haven't been married to one for 40 years, so I get the gist of it. But you do a lot of other things, and you are developing a whole brand of related, ancillary, whatever you want to call it, culinary activities. You can't tell us about some of them. Can you tell us about any?
Yes, I can talk to you about the business. I mean, the whole idea is that I've put my name above the door, and that's basically a promise. It's a brand that anyone dining at Vanzella will get the very best service, that get the very best cuisine, and that we will provide our guests with a memorable experience that they will go away and tell other people about, we hope. So that brand has a value, and I think that I can diversify my brand into other ventures. So for example, I have been working on a project called Beat, which is obviously about eating and beats. So it's about putting music with food, and I've teamed up with a DJ from Leeds, and we're providing a whole evening's experience. And the reason that we've done that is, if you look around this restaurant, which obviously your listeners can't, just to describe it, it's small, 34 covers, but it doesn't have a bar that people come in and enjoy an aperitif, or indeed a digestif later on in their evening. And you'll also notice that the demographic of our customers are significantly older than myself. So why are my friends not dining here is the question, and can I get them to come and enjoy it? And the answer to that is yes, of course. They might not be wanting this kind of experience. They might prefer to, for example, to go up onto the high street and go to the restaurant bar and grill, where they can come in, have a drink in the bar, go and have a meal with a really lively atmosphere, and then come back to the bar and enjoy listening to some music while they relax with some drinks and have a chat with their friends. So that business is doing really well, because it's got them and their wallets for their entire duration of their evening. But here, although my average spend will be higher, I won't have the entire evening. And that's a shame. And it's something that will come when I have bigger premises.
If you're getting bigger, you buy it. Oh, okay.
I hope so. Of course I hope so. I don't want another Vanzella, I don't think, but I certainly like a bigger Vanzella. So we've created this concept, which is where you can come and enjoy a three-course meal, listen to some nice music, and have great bar service, great cocktail service in a relaxed atmosphere in a pop-up restaurant. Panoramic bar and loft party, all rolled into one evening.
Oh, you're actually too much. I mean, I can't even keep up with you. And now, you were going to say to our listeners what we were going to eat tonight, but you wanted your chef to do that. Can you just sort of point out some things that we might eating? What? It's your choice.
As this is up for editing, should we quickly run through?
Yeah,
of course. So we're looking at the a la carte menu, or the equivalent of the a la carte menu. It's a set price, three courses for $49.50. And it's a choice of five starters, five main courses, and five puddings. And we currently have the ratio of, well, this is something that we've done for some time now, but the ratio is two meat starters, two fish starters, and one vegetarian starter. And the main course is three meat dishes and two fish dishes. And as you can see, we're using very local ingredients. Crab from the East Coast. Pig's head, which is from a farm just up the road by about...
Is that a real pig's head?
It is, yeah. Tête de cochon.
I want that. The only one I ever had was St.
Spice. Smoked eel. And I don't think you can go too far wrong with smoked eel. Lovely gelatinous texture, which goes well with the pig's head, but then cut with the acidity of sorrel and lemon, and then lovely texture of the dandelion. We use yellow from France, and the turnips. I mean, turnips and pork. Can't go too far wrong there. Nice little combination. And it's a combination that you'll see us use quite often, a meat and a fish, a surf and turf, if you like. And as I said, a vegetarian starter, a very important commercial decision to always have. Vegetarian starter, and it was so successful in its concept, if you will, that we now provide a seven course vegetarian tasting menu. which allows us to express pretty much the very, very best of the season from the land, and instills a great sense of creativity in the kitchen to come up with innovative ways of producing and particularly presenting vegetables that doesn't include a huge bowl of risotto or pasta or goat's cheese or anything.
I notice you have wine notes everywhere. I mean, you do have an extensive wine program.
We don't have a huge cellar, but we've just reviewed. Peter, my front of house manager, has just reviewed his wine list because we're now coming into spring and obviously the flavours and textures on the menu have changed. We have two wine suppliers, but we predominantly just use one that we work very closely with, and we're very, very happy with the service that we get and the range that we have here on the menu. It works very well for us. It took us a long time to get the wine list to where it is, but we're very proud of it now and it works well.
Okay, your email address is, the website.
Yes, of course. It's www.vanzellarestaurants.co.uk.
Well, I mean, I'm really looking forward to this meal because we've driven for 4.5 hours to get here. So you better get in that kitchen and cook up something.
It will be amazing. We really fantastic. That is brilliant. And our guests wish us well, because we're trying really, really hard to provide a fantastic experience for our diners, and we really do believe in what we're doing, and we're still here 4 years down the road of a triple dip recession or whatever it is we're in, and we've survived because we're good enough.
It was a tough times too. Well, and everybody come to Harrogate because it's a really lovely city as well. And Tom, it's been a pleasure. I'm looking forward to your meal.
A good place to find us is on Twitter, at Vanzellas.
Just in case you're wondering, you can get in touch with Anne and Peter at OTM Dish. But that's all we have for this week. We'll see you again same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then.
Bye-bye.